Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to try to talk this afternoon about an impossibly large subject, which is the subject of art, of how this thing relates to the human individual and what it's all about. It is, after all, one of the strangest things when one comes to think of it, the enormous part played by the arts in human history, and the great importance which a man has always attached to his arts. And one has to think why this should be so, and what is the relationship between the arts and human life. And as I say, the subject is enormous, and I can only touch on various aspects of it in a rather tentative way. And at the beginning, I think I must go back to what we spoke about last time, the relationship between immediate experience and symbols, because obviously the arts have a great deal to do with this problem of symbols. And we can say that in general, men have what may be called an urge to order and an urge to meaning. Man desires to think of himself as a coherent being, living in a coherent world which makes sense. And in order to live in such a world, he has to create it. He has to impose upon the world of his experience this pattern of order and of meaning. And he does this through symbols. He takes the world as he finds it, and he orders it and gives it meaning in terms of symbols. Well, when we go further back in the evolutionary development, we find that animals don't require to have systems of art because I think the reason is really that their nervous system does this for them. It imposes order and meaning for them without their having to do anything about it consciously themselves. Their nervous system does it simply by selecting from experience only certain very limited aspects which it brings to their attention. Consequently, animals live in an extraordinarily limited world. Their universes are very small compared with ours. They live in worlds in which really there are only two classes of objects which have been selected for them by their nervous system. There's just the class of edible objects, and there's the class of dangerous objects. And man, on the contrary, lives in a much more complicated world. It's not that his nervous system doesn't automatically select from experience certain aspects. It does do this process of selection and abstraction from the world, but it does it in a much more generous way than the nervous system of animals. It selects many more aspects of reality than the animals do, and consequently, our human universe is incomparably larger than the universe of even the most advanced animals. It's obviously immeasurably larger than the universe, say, of the sea urchin or the starfish. It's very much larger than the universe of the bee. And it's larger even than the universes of such animals as dogs and cats, and even much higher in the scale than that of chimpanzees. We are given by our nervous system a profusion of experience, and a profusion so great that it seems to us confusion. Profusion equals confusion. And consequently, even after our nervous system has done the selection from immediate reality, we find ourselves confused and bewildered. And we have in some way to cure our bewilderment, to make sense of ourselves and the world in which we live. And this, of course, we do by imposing a system of symbols upon the world. Now, we can say that both science and art and philosophy are three ways of making sense of the world in which we live. They are different ways in which we impose order and meaning upon the profusion, confusion, which we find when we look around us. Now, science and philosophy are concerned with explaining the confusion in terms of the fewest possible number of general principles. The whole task of theoretical science and of philosophy is really to reduce the many to a single principle, if possible, or anyhow to a few principles, to find some one or anyhow very few general principles which will give meaning and sense to this profusion with which we are presented by our nervous system. Now, the type of order and meaning sought by the artist and imposed by him upon the confusion, profusion of the world is of a different kind. He doesn't seek to explain in terms of a very few simple principles. On the contrary, he is quite prepared to consider unique and individual cases much more than the scientist is prepared to do. And his method of giving order and meaning to the world is to give it in terms of beauty. There is the order of beauty, the order of expressiveness, the order of, to use a phrase which was used originally by Clive Bell, and which, although it's quite vague and difficult to assign an exact meaning to, is still a very useful phrase, to give order to the world in terms of significant form. And what he does, I think one can say, is to look out at the world, trying to perceive the forms inherent in nature, and to find then a symbolic equivalence for these forms, which he then imposes upon the world in order to produce this order which he feels to be so supremely important, which indeed we all feel to be supremely important. Unlike the scientist, the artist seeks to impose this order of beauty and of significant form upon both aspects of reality, both the external reality and the internal reality within himself. He wants to always to see himself in relation to the world and to create symbolically a harmony in which both of them fit. In this respect, art does differ markedly, anyhow, from most types of science, that it consciously takes into account the external, the internal world as well as the external. Now, of course, the orders and meanings which the artist imposes upon the world are naturally of very different qualities. There are good orders and there are bad orders. There are good meanings and there are bad meanings. An order may be either not orderly enough when we have a chaotic work of art, or else it may be too orderly, may be rigid and conventional and boring in its formality. Or else we may have an order which is in which the elementary elements out of which the symbol system is created are excellent, but in which the total arrangement fails. Or conversely, we may have a good overall arrangement with rather inadequate elementary elements. And occasionally, of course, we get an excellent arrangement of excellent elements, in which case we have a masterpiece of art. But as we all know, masterpieces of art are rather rare. In the same way, we can have different degrees of excellence in the meanings given by artists to the world. We can have meanings which are noble and meanings which are ignoble. We can have meanings which are true to nature, are realistic, and meanings which are profoundly unrealistic. We can have really low and unpleasant meanings, and we can have fine and important meanings. And in this respect, we see where the social importance of art comes in, because one can say that to a considerable extent, the style of life of any given society at any given period is, to some extent at least, dictated by the quality of the art prevailing at that time. If the art is good and if people care for it, then on the whole, the what may be called the style of living will be on the whole good. Otherwise, if the prevailing art is bad, then the style of living may be extremely wanting in elegance and nobility. So that we see it in a certain way that the aesthetic errors and shortcomings may have social consequences. I mean that a bad work of art may in a sense be a social offense, that it can do quite a lot of harm, or anyhow fail to do a lot of good. I mean, the best works of art somehow help us to know ourselves and to know our relations with the world at our best and at the best of the world, whereas the sort of bad and inferior works of art encourage us in our weaknesses and encourage us to see the world in a completely uninteresting and insignificant way. So that, as I say, the art has a very considerable social importance as helping to create the prevailing style of a given society and making it, if the art is good, making it a good style, and if the art is bad, encouraging a bad style. The artist, of course, must proceed, the great artist I'm talking about, must proceed through understanding and sympathy. I mean, the greatness of the great artist, it seems to me, depends precisely on the width of his sympathy and the intensity of his sympathy. That there have been, of course, extremely gifted artists whose view was exceedingly narrow. They have produced remarkable works of art within a very small compass. But on the whole, I think it's true to say that the artists whom the world has always recognized as the greatest are those with the widest sympathy, the people who combine intensity with wide extension. They are able to take in, so to speak, a greater amount of material and to give order to it than the smaller artist. Whitman has some interesting remarks on this. He says, the messages of great poets to each man and woman are come to us on equal terms. Only then can you understand us. We are no better than you. What we enclose, you enclose. What we enjoy, you may enjoy. Did you suppose that there could be only one supreme? We affirm that there can be unnumbered supremes, and that one supreme does not countervail another any more than one eyesight countervails another. And he goes on to insist on the importance of sympathy. He says, there's a striking line in the Song of Myself where he says, "Whoever walks a furlong without sympathy walks to his own funeral dressed in his shroud." And he says, there's the famous line too where he said, "I am the man, I suffered, I was there." And this is followed in the poem, which incidentally is just coming out in its original edition. I've sent the proofs of this the other day. It's very interesting to compare the edition of 1855 with the later editions and to see how much better on the whole the first edition is than the later ones. But anyhow, these lines about sympathy are followed by these striking series of identifications where the poet identifies himself with different classes of different classes of suffering humanity. He identifies himself with the hunted slave. He identifies himself with the a victim of the massacre of the Alamo. He identifies himself with the sailor on the Bonhomme Richard, and so on. And it's curious to compare this Whitmanian rhapsody, which is an extremely beautiful thing, with the much more classical expression of the same idea, which we find in Matthew Arnold's Strayed Reveller, where he speaks of the poet seeing the world as clearly as the gods see it, but seeing it very differently from the way the gods see it, inasmuch as he is identified with what he looks at and suffers with what he looks at. It's summed up in Matthew Arnold's poem but in these words: "Such a price the gods exact for song, to become what we sing." Well, the process is, of course, one of becoming and then expressing what we become in terms of the most powerful and penetrating symbols possible. It's a matter of finding, as I say, this symbolic equivalent to the immediate experience of sympathy and putting it across in the most, not merely in the most expressive, but in the noblest and the finest form possible. And it is, of course, when the artist fails to put it over in the form which we recognize as noble, that we are faced with this problem of bad art and the bad social consequences which this may have. In a certain sense, we can say that the crowd in Julius Caesar, who kept shouting, "Tear him for his bad verses," we're right that the man who does write bad verses is committing some kind of a crime against society. And here I'd like to make a little digression on the two kinds of art which, the two aspects of art which are always present: the communicative aspect, art as communication, and art as therapy. All poets have constantly stressed the fact that art is a therapy. It has been they talked again and again about this power of which art has of getting rid of the painful emotions and thoughts which torment the poet, of getting rid of them simply by paying attention to them and expressing them. And this cathartic, therapeutic side of art is, of course, the side which has been found in modern psychotherapy to be so extremely important that the innumerable people with psychological problems have found, of course, that they do get a great relief in making artistic expression of their ideas. And the painful pressure within them is let loose, and they are able to carry on much more effectively as a consequence. However, what we do find now, I'm sorry to say, is that many people who take up art in an amateur way and get a great deal of pleasure out of it seem to confuse the two functions of art and imagine that because the art that they produce is for them therapeutic, that it will give pleasure to other people. This, alas, is not necessarily true. What the picture that I draw, which may be very good for me, may make you sick. And this is something which, unfortunately, many people find it very difficult to understand. But I think if we make it quite clear that art as communication is a job for specially gifted people, but that art as therapy is something which probably everybody ought to practice for his own good, if we make this clear, and also make it clear to ourselves that art as therapy is not necessarily the same as art for communication, then these distressing confusions and disappointments, which certainly affect a great many amateur artists now, will be avoided. But as I say, it is, I think, very important to remember that as well as communication, art is a very important therapy. Now, let us go back to this problem of art as contrasted with science and philosophy. In science and philosophy, probably there are two main methods of explaining reality, of giving order and meaning to reality. The one is the atomic method, the method of concentrating attention on the atomic elements of reality. And this is represented in classical antiquity by the work of Democritus and Lucretius. And of course, it's the basic methodology of modern physics and chemistry. It starts in modern times with Galileo and Newton. And comes down into nuclear physics today, and we see the method applied on the psychological level in behaviorism. On the other hand, there is the formal method, the method of concentrating attention on the gestalten of nature, on the forms which are presented on a large scale. And in the classical period, this formal approach was represented in different ways by Plato and by Aristotle. And in modern science, we see it in taxonomy, in comparative anatomy, in morphology. And incidentally, the word morphology was invented by Goethe, so has a profoundly artistic and poetic overtone to it. And in modern psychology, we see it represented in the Gestalt school. Now, in general, in most cases, I would say, art has been more interested in the second type of approach to reality, although there have also been atomic approaches in art. For example, in modern literature, we can find examples of the approach to art by the concentration on atomic elements. In the novel, for example, we find such a work as D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love, or as Dorothy Richardson's novels, or as parts of Joyce's novels. where the concentration of attention seems to be on psychological elements, psychological atoms, so to speak, so small that they are, if one may say, below the level of character and narrative. There's an analogy here with the smallest particles of physics and chemistry. In chemistry, the molecule is below the level of color, for example, or of temperature, and the atom and the subatomic particles are still lower. They're below the level of chemistry even. And analogously, in this kind of writing, we have a kind of atomic approach to reality, where only these very small elements are given, which, as I say, are, in a sense, below the level of character and of narrative. Nevertheless, they do give us, I think, remarkable, when they're used very well, give us remarkable insights into reality. And I would think that, again, perhaps on the level of music, in the field of music, we may find something analogous. It always struck me, anyhow, that this was something analogous in the works, say, of the French composer Boulez, where the tones are almost atomic and are used in a way which makes a music which is again so atomic as to be below the level of melody and the ordinary forms of construction. And something of the kind, I think, can be seen in some manifestations of non-representational art. I would think that some of the paintings, for example, of Jackson Pollock may be looked at in the same way, as being art in which the artist has concentrated on the atomic elements of form, which are below the level of pattern in the ordinary sense, below the level of geometry, below the level of representation of natural objects. Again, these atomic approaches are, if they're well done, can be extremely interesting, although I think we should get extremely tired of them after a certain time. In general, however, art has concentrated on the formal elements. It's concentrated on not on the atoms composing the reality, but on the gestalts, the general patterns which it finds. It has looked for these patterns in the outside world, and it has sought, by means of symbolic equivalents of these patterns, to impose an overall order and meaning on the reality which it finds so confusing. And I think a brief digression must be made about the nature of these patterns, these symbolic forms which artists have chosen. Obviously, we art is divided into two main classes: those forms of art which deal with spatial reality, and those forms of art which deal with reality where a time element comes in. And we shall find, I think, in both these cases, that the symbols used by artists have a relationship with patterns occurring in the external world. Let us consider one of the fundamentals of art, which is also one of the fundamentals of living objects in the natural world, the question of symmetry and asymmetry. Obviously, symmetry plays an immense part in both nature and in art. And as we see when we examine living creatures, there are two main forms of symmetry. There is the symmetry of the free living animal, which has a bilateral symmetry. Its two sides match one another, but it is different fore and aft. It has a head and a tail, and it moves in one direction. This is, of course, radically different from the radial symmetry, which we find in so many flowers, and which we also find in a special kind of animals, which are only the sessile and free, passively floating animals, which don't have the capacity for moving purposefully in any one direction, but either stand still or just float about. And when we examine the way in which artists have used symmetry with their symbols, we see very clearly that where radial symmetry occurs as a symbol in art, it is always associated with ideas of repose and restfulness. Symmetry of symbols having the other kind of symmetry, the bilateral symmetry, but asymmetry in the other direction, seem to have something dynamic and powerful and aimed about them. This is strikingly illustrated, I think, when we contrast the domes and the round arches of the Byzantine and Romanesque architecture with the spires and the pointed arches of Gothic. The first give us a strong impression of repose and staticness, and the others are an equally powerful impression of dynamic purposefulness and movement and aim. So that we see that there is here a strong, a close relationship between the meaningfulness of symbols and the kind of facts in the outer world which we observe and which we unconsciously transfer to our symbols. And of course, in the outside world, the mathematical relationships within the patterns are often very close or identical with, close to or identical with, the mathematical relations within the forms, the symbolic forms, which we find satisfactory in art. For example, the golden section, which underlies practically the whole compositional procedure of the Western world, is frequently found in nature. And such mathematical relationships as the Fibonacci series and the logarithmic spiral occur both in nature and are found frequently in art and are felt to be profoundly satisfactory. And a curious and interesting point, I think, is this, that the mathematical relations which hold in patterns which are used by animals as what modern ethologists call releaser mechanisms are very simple and striking patterns which are easily recognized even by animals on a quite low level. And the interesting thing is that these patterns involving quite simple mathematical relationships are felt by human beings to be aesthetically very significant and very satisfactory. So that again we see that there is this tendency to take patterns out of the natural world and to use them either directly or in an analogous way in symbols. And in the same way, in temporal symbols, we find the same use of natural rhythms. After all, in any form of temporal art, which is poetry, drama, narrative, dancing, music, we find the same elementary symbols being used, which are repetitions, variations on a theme, rhythms of a more or less circular nature, or rhythms proceeding, so to speak, in a straight or an undulating line. And these are all, and analogies of all these are found in nature. After all, the movement of the heavenly bodies is a pattern in the sky, the cycle of growth, the physiological patterns, of rhythms of breathing, of heart activity, of peristalsis, and so on. All these, and of course the more irregular rhythms, such as hunger and satisfaction, craving and satiation, all these find their analogy, I think, in the various arts which contain an element of time. That again, man looks in the external world, sees these cosmic and physiological rhythms around him, makes an analog of them in his temporal arts, and uses them to impose upon what Whitehead calls the flux of perpetual perishing a satisfactory pattern, a rhythmic and repetitive pattern, which to him gives meaning and order to something which, when it is not ordered, is apt to seem terrifying, which is, as I say, this flux of perpetual perishing, this continuous duration moving towards an inevitable darkness in the future. Man has to make these patterns to give a kind of sense and coherence and meaning to the flux of time, and he derives them from elements in nature, strengthens them up in his system of symbols, and then reimposes them upon nature so as to make nature more coherent in his own mind. Now, we have to consider what happens when the artist decides to create. What psychologically, what is he doing? I think what he does may roughly be described in this way, that he pays attention to something in his own mind or in the external world, which he is interested in and which he wants to reduce to symbols and express. And then he sort of leaves himself open to anything which may come into his mind, which may enrich his ideas about what he is paying attention to, and permit him to impose a more elaborate and subtle order upon the symbol system which he is going to make. Anything which comes into his mind may be used in this process. There may be associations with events in his past life. It may be a question of pieces of scientific or philosophical or historical knowledge. Maybe things observed here and there in the external world. All this is grist to his mill. And these things, so to speak, are allowed to drift into the mind and are then, by the imagination, harmonized into a whole and expressed in the symbolic terms appropriate to the particular art in question. And the imagination performs this curious work of bringing things into harmony with one another. The definition of imagination given by Coleridge is a very famous one, probably familiar with it, but I think it's worth reading again. He says that imagination, he defines it as the power which reveals itself in the balance or reconciliation of opposite or discordant qualities, of sameness with difference, of the general with the concrete, of the idea with the image, the sense of novelty and freshness with old and familiar objects. This, I think, is extremely important in all considerations of art, this power of the imagination of bringing together disparate and often apparently completely mutually irrelevant or even mutually hostile objects of knowledge or experience and fusing them together in a single whole. Now, on the small scale, on the what may be called the molecular scale of art, we see the power of imagination illustrated very clearly in literature by the metaphor. The metaphor is essentially a bringing together by the imagination of elements which are fundamentally disparate and irrelevant to one another and making of them a new whole which strikes us when we read it as being profoundly significant and giving a new meaning and order to these, not only to the elements which are brought together, but to the point which they illustrate. Let me give a few examples of good metaphors. For example, there's the metaphor in Macbeth about sleep, where he says, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of thought. Well, here you see the metaphor is the ball of silk which has been tangled by the kitten playing with it and sleep smoothing this out and putting it into order again, which is an extremely powerful and beautiful metaphor. And then there's the metaphor which we find in the Tempest, where Prospero says the strongest oaths are straw to the fire in the blood. Again, a very powerful metaphor. And here I think it's worth remarking how these metaphors depend on a certain type of economic and social order. I was just thinking the other day that to a child brought up in a city apartment, this metaphor would mean nothing at all. He's never seen straw. And he has never, if he lives in a well-heated apartment, never seen a fire. So that probably, if he were writing this, he would probably say, he knows about oaths, because he's read about loyalty oaths, of course. He would say the strongest oaths are celluloid, the short circuit in the blood. I mean, anyhow, if we have had the luck to be brought up in the old-fashioned countryside and to see fires, now this is a very powerful and illuminating metaphor. And the same kind of illumination of the force and violence of desire is expressed in another Shakespearean metaphor, where he says, and those milk paps that through the window bars bore at men's eyes. And then I think of a striking metaphor which occurs in one of the poems of Gerald Manley Hopkins, where he speaks about the horror of being an isolated ego, where he says, self yeast of spirit, a dull dough sours. Again, the fact of the religious tragedy of being this egotistical, self-resisting God is illustrated by this extremely homely metaphor of yeast in bread. And then there's a beautiful metaphor in Julius Caesar where Portia says to Brutus, dwell I but in the suburbs of your good pleasure. Very striking metaphor again. And here's I want to read the whole of this very extraordinary sonnet by George Herbert on prayer, which is a whole series of rather extravagant but very beautiful metaphors which illustrate very clearly this imaginative power of bringing odd, disparate elements together to illustrate the point of issue. Prayer, the church's banquet, angels' age, God's breath in man returning to its birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage, the Christian plummet sounding heaven and earth, engine against the Almighty, sinner's tower, reversed thunder, Christ's side-piercing spear, the 6 days world transforming in an hour, a kind of tune which all things hear and fear. Softness and peace and joy and love and bliss, exalted manner, gladness at the best, heaven in ordinary, man well-dressed, the Milky Way, the bird of paradise. Church bells beyond the stars heard, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. The end is really extraordinary, where this whole series of extravagant metaphors ends up just with this something understood. And of course it's perfectly true that these extravagant metaphors, where the imagination has brought in elements from all over the place, do permit us to understand this mysterious process of prayer, which Herbert, the passionate, ecstatic Christian, is talking about. Well, an interesting sidelight on this thing of metaphors is cast by the Chinese system of writing. The Chinese, of course, don't use the alphabet, they use ideographs, which are in many cases crystallized metaphors. They bring together disparate elements which are symbolized in a single character and which stand for certain ideas. For example, thus the word, the character which stands for good, contains the two characters of woman and child, a very touching and beautiful symbol. But again, the Chinese were very realistic people. And they knew, as Bacon said, that women and children were hostages to fortune, and that a man who has given hostages to fortune is impeded in many ways. And consequently, the symbol for woman in conjunction with another symbol, which in its literal sense stands for square, means hinder. So that here again, this is very, very interesting to see these two crystallized metaphors, which lead us to enormous fields of thought. The Chinese person who sees these symbols is stimulated to think about what the words, what the symbols stand for and the significance of them, in a way which our alphabetical writing, although far more efficient and utilitarian than the Chinese, never does. Well, on the large scale, the imagination, of course, harmonizes these small elementary elements of art and much larger patterns into the great whole of the complete work of art. And here, I think one must emphasize a fact which I feel very strongly, although I think there's a number of contemporary critics disagree with. I would feel strongly that there is a hierarchy in perfections, that you can have artistic perfection on a very small scale, and it is a perfection, but it is a perfection of a lower order than the perfection which is the perfection on the large scale, which is the harmonization of very many aspects of experience into a harmonious whole. For example, the song, Full Fathom Five, Thy Father Lies, is a perfection. There's no question about this. It's an incredibly beautiful small piece of poetry. But I would certainly say that this perfection is of a lower order than the perfection of, say, Macbeth or Hamlet, which is combines an immense mass of material into an artistically satisfying whole. And I would say that, for example, in the sphere of the visual arts, you can a piece of Sung pottery is perfect, but its perfection is of a lower order than, say, one of the best of the Sung landscapes, which harmonizes a greater number of elements. And a piece of weaving or a carpet may be perfect, but it is a perfection of a lower order than, say, the Assumption of El Greco, or the Nativity of Piero, the Dos de Mayo of Goya, which harmonize many more elements. And if I may venture to criticize a contemporary manifestation of art, I would think that a great many non-representational works, although extremely beautiful, the best of them, I think, are extremely beautiful, are works of a perfection whose order is less great, of a lower order, than the perfection of any of the great compositions which I mentioned before, simply because they harmonize far fewer elements. I mean, a work like the Nativity or the Dos de Mayo harmonizes not only extraordinarily complicated systems of forms and colors, but also every kind of human feeling, ethical value judgments, and so on. There's a kind of modern Puritanism which thinks that these so-called literary judgments should be omitted entirely from works of art. Why this should be, considering human beings have been doing this for the last 5,000 years, I don't know. But my own view is that if you can have a work of art which does harmonize all these elements, other things being equal, its perfection will be superior to those which harmonize only a few elements. And as I say, this is not agreed to by many contemporary critics, but it seems to me to make a profound sense. Now, very briefly, let's go into the question of the different kinds of art. In the 100 years ago, 150 years ago, it was assumed, of course, that there was only one kind of satisfactory visual art, which was the Greco-Roman Renaissance type. Well, we've got past this simply because we know a great deal more than our parents knew. Photography and anthropology have put at our disposal the entire range of art for the last 100,000 years. I mean, we now have seen the works done by Paleolithic man. We have seen entire new cultures have come into existence, which were just come into our ken, which were simply not known when I was a boy. I mean, even in my own lifetime, this extraordinary enlargement of our view of art and of culture. So that we now know that there are many different kinds of art, and that, as Whitman says, there are many forms of the supreme, and that these all have a perfect right to their own existence. We see this, I mean, I'm still talking about the visual works field, because they're easier to discuss than the others. But I mean, we see from the very beginning these extraordinary differences in style. For example, in the Paleolithic art, if any of you visited the caves at Lascaux in France and have seen the extraordinary pictures of animals there, you will see that man, 20,000 years ago, I think this is about the date, painted in a fantastically naturalistic way these animal figures. He was, I would imagine, that he was using what Jentsch and his fellow psychologists call eidetic imagery, that he had this capacity for, with his eyes shut, to re-see what he had seen with absolute fidelity and to somehow project this upon the wall of the cave. Well, then, 10,000 years later, when we come to Neolithic art, we find a totally different approach to the problems of art. We find that everything is represented in an entirely symbolic and abstract form, that the human figure, animal figures, have been reduced to the most abstract kind of expressionism. Then, of course, we find the the intense and violent expressionism of many types of so-called primitive art, of African art, of Polynesian art, of pre-Columbian art, which consist in projecting internal feelings in the strongest possible way into external forms, which are then distorted by the extraordinary power of emotion which is being poured into them. Then we have the art involving what may be called empathy, of feeling into the external world, which is illustrated very clearly in Chinese landscape painting or in Impressionism. Then we have purely decorative art, the art of the arabesque, which the Muslims were condemned to practice because they were not allowed to represent human forms. And we have a sort of architectonic art, the geometrical, building up geometrical forms, such as we see in Cubism. All these have been illustrated at one time or another in different places, different parts of the world, and all are obviously perfectly legitimate methods of giving order and meaning to the world. Oh, and I may add, there's also the art of pure fantasy, the art of dream, the art of surrealism, and which is another perfectly legitimate way of giving order and meaning to reality. And all these, as I say, are, one does not disvalue the other. They are all supremes of equal value, I mean, and a perfection can be achieved in each one of them. Now, I want to end up with a very few words about the most difficult of all these subjects, which is music, which is a very mysterious field of art, simply because the symbols of which it makes use are so remote from our immediate experience. After all, in literature, we're using words which have a meaning fixed in advance, and in painting, we are using forms which we're fairly familiar with in the external world in general. But in music, we are using tones which seem to have a sort of life of their own apart from the external world, and using rhythms which, though they have analogies with natural rhythms, are strangely independent of them. And yet, as all great musicians have insisted, and as I think anybody who has listened with understanding to music agrees, yet music has some kind of cognitive meaning. It does say something about the nature of the world. Beethoven insisted on this very strongly, and we find similar statements, I think, in almost every great composer. They have this intense feeling that what they're saying isn't just a mere pattern of sound. It has some sort of meaning. It tells one something about the nature of the universe. And of course, I suppose, on the strictly individual basis, these complicated rhythms do tell us something about the equally complicated rhythms going on in the inner life of man. These are probably quite inexpressible in words, but then a great many things are inexpressible in words. We see the inexpressibility of music in words when we read any program explanation. I mean, those programs saying at this point Beethoven was expressing his agony at having departed from his lady love or something of the kind. The next program will say at this point Beethoven was laughing uproariously over the comedy of the human life. And the same kind of phenomenon, musical phenomenon, as we see again and again, is interpreted in words in different ways. All this proves is that words are extremely unsatisfactory means for saying what music is about, which is certainly about these very subtle and obscure kind of movements within the human organism, the mind, body, the spirit. And maybe at the same time, music is about something in the universe at large. It seems to be to express a kind of pure non-physical dynamism in the external world. It seems even to talk about something which Bergson described when he spoke of William James. He said that according to his view, James's view, we bathe in an atmosphere traversed by great spiritual currents, the powerful feelings which stir the soul at special moments are forces as real as those that interest the physicist. Man does not invent them any more than he invents light or heat. And this may sound a rather mystical view of what music stands for, and what indeed I think all the arts stand for, but my own feeling is that there is a profound truth in this, that all the arts are, although they speak about us in our relationship to the immediate experience, yet at the same time do tell us something about the nature of the world, about these mysterious forces which we feel to be around us, and about the cosmic order of which we seem to have glimpses. I shall have more to say about this, these strange forces and this cosmic order in a lecture in the future. But meanwhile, let me close this present lecture with apologies for the rather sketchy and jumpy nature of my presentation this afternoon, but it was the subject was so enormous, and it was necessary to select so almost at random small aspects of it, that it was very difficult to be more coherent in the time at my disposal. Thank you.